This is audiobook of Here and Hereafter by Anthony Borgia. Preface. Since the first of our scripts was published, there has been a steady stream of letters from readers all over the world, each of them showing an immense interest in psychic science and, in particular, in the subject matter of the scripts themselves. So much so, indeed, that our readers have constantly asked for still more information upon this important subject. In compiling the scripts, our communicator's chief problem, he has always said, is not so much what to say, but what to omit, since, he says regretfully, with the limitations of space it is impossible, in describing the life and people of so vast a place as the spirit world, to get a quart into a pint pot. It is inevitable, therefore, that much interesting matter should be omitted altogether or have but fugitive reference to it. With this in mind, but chiefly in view of the great number of requests for additional information, our communicator has dictated this present volume, which was completed in 1957, and I use the word dictated in its literal sense. As with the previous scripts, I received the dictation by means of clairaudience. Should this fail, as at times it is almost inevitable that it should, then direct inspiration was resorted to, it mattered not which, for both were equally effective. For my part, every care was exercised to ensure absolute accuracy and authenticity, and to this end I was anxious that the scripts should have some sort of independent verification, at least my share of them. This I was able to do through the services of a non-professional transmedium of the highest integrity, during the course of twice-weekly circle sittings. I was thus able to talk directly to the communicator, who gave me his verbal assurance independently that I had taken down correctly all he had to say. Interested readers may be wishful to know, perhaps, how the communicator views the results of his achievement regarding the previous books and their penetration into many lands. He says with warm appreciation, "I am delighted with the results that have far exceeded my expectation." A voluminous, worldwide correspondence has itself been a revelation, our readers being folk of all ages, from a youthful 20 to an equally youthful 80 years of age. Throughout all the letters, I have been almost overwhelmed by the writer's many expressions of appreciation and gratitude, of cordiality and warmth. "Life in the world unseen," writes one minister of the church, "has given me much inspiration. Thank you most sincerely." And the wife of a clergyman wrote to say, "I have read your indescribably lovely book through twice already, and hope to read it many times more." It is not surprising, therefore, that our communicator should have feelings of justifiable gratification. Here and Hereafter is, in fact, complete in itself, and while it is not a sequel to the two previous books, it bears a thematic relationship to them by responding to our readers' oft-repeated entreaties, in the words of Goethe, "For light, more light." A.B. Introduction. It seems incredible that the organized body known, collectively, as the Church, while speaking repeatedly and familiarly of heaven, confesses to knowing nothing whatever about that future state. A clergyman once wrote to me that 9/10 of his congregation did not believe in a hereafter at all. On the other hand, one church in particular claims to know a good deal about hell, one of its most important features being that once a person has got into it, there is no getting out of it. One's residence there is for all eternity. A priest of this church was once asked if he really believed in hell. "Oh, yes," he replied. "But I don't believe anyone ever goes there." The church has made the hereafter into a place of mystery, and the whole subject of a future state has been wrapped round with a mantle of religiosity, until people have come to look upon it with fear, with awe, with skepticism, with ridicule, with horror, and with a variety of other emotions according to their several temperaments of upbringings. Death can come to a person slowly or rapidly, but it must inevitably come sooner or later. There is no dodging it. It has been going on since life began. Would it not be a relief to many minds, then, if they knew something, even if only a little, about the possible or probable state of their being after they have made the change from this life to the next? In other words, What sort of place is the next world? The only way to find out is to ask someone who lives there, and to record what is said. And the latter is precisely what has been done in this present volume as in the two that have preceded it. It is again necessary to say that I first came to know the communicator of this book, Monsignor Robert Hugh Benson, many years ago. A son of Edward White Benson, former Archbishop of Canterbury, he was then at the summit of his fame both as author and preacher. By telling others, who are still on earth, of his experiences in the spirit world, he will have attained more than his purpose if he is able to cast out of people's minds the fear of death and the hereafter. Anthony Borgia. The Threshold. When we first began to set down the joint experiences of Edwin, Ruth, and myself of our life in the spirit world, I was told that there would be some who would take exception to what I had to say upon one particular incident or another. Indeed, that was almost bound to happen among thinking people whose eye I should be fortunate enough to catch. The thoughts of many persons still upon earth have come to us here in the spirit world as a consequence of the narration of those experiences. Some there are who have thought to themselves, and, indeed, voiced the opinion to their friends, that the descriptions I had given of the spirit world, or rather, of that part of it with which I am acquainted, are almost too good to be true. An ideal state, they would say, that is too wonderful to exist an actual fact. The picture I have painted, they would continue, is an imaginative one, and has no existence outside the imagination. Now, that attitude of mind is not confined to the earth. People who are newly arrived in the spirit world express exactly the same opinion upon thousands of occasions. They simply cannot realize the concrete existence of all the wonders and beauties and marvels that they see around them. At least, they cannot do so at first. When they do realize it, their joy is supreme. So that, if seeing these entrancing things brings with it an initial and temporary disbelief, then it is not surprising. In Life in the World Unseen. And more about Life in the World Unseen. That mere descriptions of them should engender something of a similar disbelief among people still upon earth. But the validity of my descriptions still remains, whatever adverse opinion or disagreement may be expressed upon them. I cannot alter the truth. What Edwin, Ruth, and I have seen, millions of other folk also have seen, and are still seeing and enjoying. We would not have one tiny fragment of these conditions altered. They are our life, and they afford us the greatest satisfaction and happiness. When the time comes for any one of us to depart for realms higher above us in spiritual progression, we shall never for a single instant regret the period we have passed in these realms. They will always remain a fragrant and happy memory, and it will always be permissible for us to return to these realms whenever we so wish. There is an enormous number of people throughout the entire earth that prefers to leave the whole subject of an afterlife alone. These people regard it as an unhealthy subject, and treat the very thought of death as morbid. If such people were truly honest with themselves, they would admit that such a state of mind merely increases their fear of death and the hereafter, instead of reducing it. They believe that by sweeping the question completely from their minds, they will also have dismissed the real fear that so many people have, an instinct, they would say, of self-preservation. Others who are more fortunate and who have no such fears, will divide the unseen world into two principal departments, namely a place where the wicked will go when they leave the earth, and a place where the not so wicked, in which category they would, perhaps, place themselves, will eventually find themselves. The average earth dweller has no notion what kind of place the next world can possibly be, usually because he has not given much thought to the matter. How those very same people regret their indifference when they eventually arrive here in the spirit world. Why, they cry, were we not told about this before we came here? Now, all this arises from the fact that the average person does not know of what he himself is composed. He knows he has a physical body, of course. There are not many who can easily forget it. But leaving the earth in the common act of dying is a perfectly natural and normal process, which has been going on continuously, without intermission, for thousands upon thousands of earthly years. Man will proudly point to the vast achievements that these passing centuries have seen. He will tell you of the world-shaking discoveries he has made, and remind you of the countless inventions for the greater happiness and well-being of man on earth. He will tell you how civilized he has become by comparison with his ancestors of medieval times. He will tell you that he has exact knowledge of this or that, and that many years and vast sums of money have been spent in acquiring that knowledge. But officially, man has neglected the most important study of all, the study of himself, and, arising from it, the study of his ultimate destination when, after his very, very brief span of life on earth, the time comes for him to leave it at death and to journey forth, where? It is commonly understood that man is composed of body, soul, and spirit. The physical body he is fairly conversant with, but what of the soul and spirit? Of these two man knows little indeed. What he does not realize is that he is a spirit, first, last, and always. The physical body is merely a vehicle for his spirit body upon his journey through his earthly life. The mind belongs to the spirit body. Every human experience, every thought, word, and deed, that go to make up the sum of earthly human experience is infallibly and ineradicably recorded upon what is called the subconscious mind through the agency of the physical brain, and when the time comes for man to leave the earth, he discards the physical body forever, leaves it behind him upon the earth, and passes into the realms of the spirit world. His spirit body he will find, is a counterpart of the earthly body he has just left behind him. He will then find that what he called the subconscious mind when he was incarnate has now assumed its rightful place in his new scheme of existence. And it is not long before it begins to show its particular attributes to its owner. By its principal ability of ineffaceable and infallible recording, this mind reveals itself as a complete and perfect chronicle of its owner's life upon earth. The revelations, therefore, that are attendant upon the person newly arrived in the spirit world can be sufficiently startling. It is customary among certain minds of the earth to regard the spirit world and its inhabitants as vague and shadowy, extremely unsubstantial and speculative. These same minds regard the dwellers in spirit lands as a class of subhuman beings who are immeasurably worse off than themselves simply because they are dead. To be upon earth is normal, sound, and healthy, and infinitely to be preferred. To be dead is unfortunate but, of course, inevitable, very unhealthy, and anything but normal. The dead are much to be pitied because they are not alive on earth. This line of thought tends to place an undue importance upon the earthly life and upon the physical body of man. It is as though it were only at the point of death that man takes upon himself any spiritual nature, whereas, in truth, that spiritual nature has been present within him since the moment of his drawing his first breath upon earth. The whole process of leaving the earth, of dying, is a perfectly natural one. It is merely the operation of a natural law. But for thousands of years the generality of people have lived in entire ignorance of the truth of dying and of the hereafter. And in this, as in so many cases, ignorance, or lack of knowledge, means fear. It is fear of the future following upon death that has surrounded the act of transition with so many mournful and morbid solemnities and doleful trappings. Sorrow is but natural in human hearts at the parting of loved ones and in their removal from physical sight, but sorrow is aggravated and increased by the lack of knowledge of what precisely has taken place. Orthodox religion is largely responsible for this state of affairs. The one who is mourned has gone to an unknown land where, presumably, an omnipotent God reigns supreme, ready to mete out judgment to all who enter that world. It behoves us, therefore, Orthodoxy would urge in effect, that we should do all that we can to placate this great judge, that he may deal mercifully with our departed brother. Such a situation, it would be further urged, is no time for anything but the gravest demeanor, the most solemn behavior. And how does the departed soul view all these adjuncts of death? Sometimes with disgust, sometimes with amazement at their stupidity, sometimes, and especially with those whose sense of humor is well developed, with undisguised mirth. And what of all the paraphernalia of death? Has it availed the departed soul anything? No, nothing. Black garments, drawn blinds, ponderous solemnity, hushed voices, and countenances of exaggerated gloom are utterly worthless to help the soul upon its way. Indeed, the reverse can, in many cases, be the result. But of that I will speak to you later. For the moment I wish to show you that dying is the operation of a simple and natural law, that it is healthy and normal to consider the subject, and discuss it, and find out all about it. Surely the greatest stimulus to inquiry should be occasioned by the thought that every single soul born upon earth must, at some time or another, face the death of his physical body. Let us begin, then, by briefly sketching the operation of physical death. The spirit body exactly coincides with the physical body, and during waking hours the two are inseparable. When sleep takes place, the spirit body withdraws from the physical body, but the former is attached to the latter by a magnetic cord. I call it a magnetic cord for want of a better name. It is a veritable lifeline. Its elasticity is enormous, since the spirit body can travel either throughout the earth during sleeping hours, or throughout the spirit world subject to special conditions and limitations. However vast the distance between the sleeping physical body and the temporarily released spirit body, the magnetic cord can span the distance easily and perfectly and without any diminution of its active agency, which is to sustain life in the earthly body. The lifeline will, as its length increases, become exceedingly fine and almost hair-like in appearance. Just so long as the magnetic cord is joined to the earthly body, just so long will earthly life remain in the physical body. But the moment that dissolution takes place, the lifeline is severed, the spirit is free to live in its own element, while the physical body will decay in the manner which is perfectly familiar to you upon earth. And as far as the physical body is concerned, it is closely akin to ordinary sleep. There does not seem anything very dreadful about this straightforward process if a little thought is given to it. I have already spoken to you concerning my own passage to this world of the spirit. It was easy and comfortable, and I was certainly not aware of any distress when the actual moment arrived for the magnetic cord to break from my physical body. As far as I was concerned, there was no shock or struggle, no unpleasant circumstances of any description. Since my own advent into spirit lands, I have talked with many friends upon this matter, and not one of them was aware by any internal or external incident that their magnetic cord had parted from their physical bodies. In this respect, the actual process of dissolution is painless. Whatever suffering is endured by the person whose transition is imminent, is purely physical. That is to say, it is the cause of physical death, from disease, for example, or accident, that may bring pain and not the actual death itself. If doctors can relieve the pain, and there is no reason why in all cases they should not, then the whole course of dissolution would be entirely painless. Why should the severance of the magnetic cord be a painful operation? If it were, it would surely suggest that there was some fault in the heavenly scheme of things. But there is no fault, and death is painless. And now, what happens next? Just this. The person who has just passed into spirit lands goes to his own self-appointed place. At the very outset, this would seem to suggest that I have overlooked what is known as judgment, where every man shall be judged according to his merits and rewarded or condemned, received into heaven, or sent to hell. No, I have not overlooked it, because there is no such thing as being judged at any time, either by the Father of the universe or by any single soul that lives in the spirit world. There is no judgment day. Man, himself, is his own judge. His thoughts, his words, and his deeds, registered upon his mind, are his only judge, and according to how his earthly life has been lived, so will his place be in these lands of the spirit world. This is another natural law, and like all the laws of the spirit world, perfect in its operation. It requires no interpreters of it, no exponents of it. it is self-acting and incorruptible, and, what is most important, it is impartial and infallible. The old idea of a recording angel, whose especial function is to inscribe in a great book all our good deeds and all our bad deeds, is poetic enough, but completely wrong. We do our own recording for ourselves, and this is one instance at least when we speak truly. We cannot hide our bad deeds, but, also, we cannot conceal our good deeds. I am using the word deeds in a general sense. What really counts in our earthly lives is the motive behind our deeds. Our motives may be of the highest, but the actual deed may have a poor external appearance. And the reverse is equally true. For example, a man may give vast sums of money for some charitable purpose with the sole thought of personal publicity and self-aggrandizement. While the gift itself may do great good to those upon whom it is bestowed, the motive behind the gift will not be to the giver's spiritual advantage. But if this same donor were to perform a small service to another person in difficulty or similar circumstances, all not witnessed by a third party, and with the sole intention of helping a fellow mortal in distress, such unobtrusive and stealthy service brings a rich reward to him who performs it. It is motive, always, that counts. The richest services are most often those that are performed without a fanfare of trumpets. So many of us here in the spirit world are surprised when we discover that some small service that we have done, and immediately afterwards forgotten, has helped us in our spiritual progression to an extent that we should scarcely have thought possible. But here we see things in their proper light, that is, in their true light, because they are registered within ourselves in their true light. So you see, we need no one to condemn us. No one could condemn us more strictly, more exactly, more truly and efficiently than we do ourselves. When we come to the spirit world at our dissolution, we thus find ourselves in the precise environment for which we have fitted ourselves. That environment may be one of darkness or of light, or it may be one of gloomy greyness. But wherever it may be, we have ourselves to thank, or blame for it. But, you will naturally ask, having in mind certain orthodox religious teachings on the subject, are those who dwell in greyness or darkness confined to those regions for all eternity? No, no, never for all eternity. They will remain there for just so long as they wish. Indeed, some of them have lived in the dark realms for thousands of years, but thousands of years is not eternity, although it may seem like it sometimes to some of the inhabitants of those regions. But every soul so situated in darkness is free to terminate his sojourn there whenever he sees fit. The choice rests with himself. If the denizens of the darker regions show no aptitude towards spiritual progression and soul lifting themselves out of the darkness, then they will remain where they are. No one forces them to stay there. They themselves elect to do so. The instant that one of the unhappy inhabitants shows the most minute tendency to lift himself out of the sad conditions of those dark realms, such tendency becomes a wish that others higher up can see, and every help is given to that soul to place his feet firmly and strongly upon the upward path of progression. That pathway may be steep and difficult, but neither so steep nor difficult but that someone cannot help him to surmount all the obstacles upon the way. This is spiritual progression in the fullest sense of the word. It is open to all. We in this beautiful realm of light are all working for our spiritual advancement. It is not restricted to those who live in the dark regions. The people who inhabit the magnificent spheres above this wherein I dwell are all moving forward and upward in their triumphant progress ional march. It never ceases, and spiritual progress is the birthright of every single soul. The whole crude conception of being damned for all eternity arises from a totally wrong conception of the Father of the universe, a grotesque conception that has found its supporters throughout the centuries, and that has, in consequence, put fear into the hearts of mankind. It is a man-made belief without the slightest foundation in fact. And it is not long before a newcomer to the spirit world finds out that the whole idea of eternal damnation is an utterly impossible one. And now, here is something that Edwin, Ruth, and I discovered early in our joint endeavors, when newly arrived persons, who obviously could never qualify for eternal damnation, are told that such a thing does not, never did, or ever will exist, they exhibit an immensely strong sense of relief. They usually explain that this feeling of relief is not, as it were, on their own behalf, but partly on behalf of all those others less fortunate than themselves, and partly from the far-reaching possibilities and prospects that this absence of eternal damnation suggests to their minds. They see at once that the whole spirit world lies before them in equal right with their fellow human beings, and that the God of whom they were always rather frightened when on earth is a Father of unlimited and illimitable benevolence, and one moreover, who could never breathe vengeance upon any one of his children. That in itself is an illuminating discovery which is of great service to the newcomer to spirit lands, since it at once opens his mind to the truth. A moment ago I told you that the person who has just passed into the spirit world goes to his own self-appointed place, but you hear of individuals, who are new arrivals, wandering about aimlessly, apparently lost, and who do not seem to know what has befallen them. Can it be that they do not know that they have passed on? Such is the state of spiritual enlightenment of the earth that in many cases these folk are completely unaware that they have died. That means simply that they have never ceased to live. There has been an unbroken continuity of life for them, as indeed there is for all of us. This situation frequently arises among people who pass into the spirit world suddenly and perhaps without warning. Their lack of knowledge of conditions existing in the spirit world produces this state of bewilderment, and if there is added to that ignorance also the fact that, during their earthly life, they never gave any heed to a future life in the spirit world, then their situation becomes a doubly unhappy one. But there is in the spirit world a vast organization of all its immense resources, and it must not be thought that these bewildered souls are left to shift for themselves. They are soon taken in hand by others long resident in spirit lands, as you judge time, who devote their spirit lives to such work. Edwin, Ruth and I have for years been engaged upon this identical work, so that I can speak from particular experience. Our task is often a difficult one because it is not always easy for the soul to grasp what has happened. The mental equipment of the individual may cause a reluctance to accept the truth. On the other hand, those who are mentally alert will soon see for themselves the exact situation. If only knowledge of the laws and conditions of spirit life were universally diffused throughout the earth world, what a wealth of difference it would make to each soul as he came to reside in these lands. Was anyone ever so ill-equipped for a journey as is the average person for the journey into these spirit lands? It is a journey that all must take, and how many even bother to think about it during their earthly life? This voyage is inevitable, without failure. But so many thousands of people are perfectly content to dismiss from their minds all thought of it until the time comes to take it. Many have no chance even at the last moment to think about it, so sudden is their transition. How many people living on earth would be foolish enough to undertake a journey with their eyes blindfolded, not knowing how far they were traveling? Or whence, or to what conditions of living? Yet so many are willing to embark upon the first great voyage of their lives in absolute ignorance of all these factors. We in the spirit world are constantly seeing these bewildered souls arriving, and we do our best for them. We have then no need to chide them, for they are the first to blame themselves. And as often as not, they do so in good round terms. I think if one were asked what was the most common mental state in which the majority of people arrive in the spirit world, I should be disposed to reply from a fairly extensive experience, that they arrive in a state of bewilderment and complete ignorance of the fact that they have passed from the earth world. Speaking for myself, I was more fortunate than a great many, for I did know what was happening from my slight acquaintance with psychic matters. Even slender knowledge is of help in such cases, and I was glad of it then. Relatives and friends, who have passed on before us, can help in such extremities, and they frequently do so. But some mutual interest must exist first, even if it does not reach to the state of affectionate regard. Affection is the great linking force in the spirit world. Without it, a gulf comes between people.